Insights to Live By, the podcast, where we discover new pearls of wisdom to put into action and enrich the daily lives of others. Well, hello and good day, everyone. And when I say good day, it's not just about greetings and salutations. It's a good day. So, good day and welcome to Insights to Live By. I am your host, Matt Zinman, and I'm just going to come out and say it. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Now, it's not an every show thing, but I do have a certain ask to start the show, which is to bring 3 steps closer to fruition my intention to personally enrich the lives of at least 100 million people by 2025. I sincerely appreciate your appreciation for Insights to Live By, but there's no need to keep it to yourself. Instead, tell a friend, family member, coworker, maybe one of each, and see how they like it. It's only 3 more people to enjoy the cost-free, ad-free episode, and for that, once again, thank you. Now, I can't speak for you, mainly because I'm not you, but for me, there are some lingering questions that are top of mind, like, how does one persist and push forward with positivity even when faced with adversity? And what does it take to refuse to allow ourselves to be anything less than the best version of who we are meant to be? Thankfully, here to answer those questions in this week's guest episode is Christopher J. Wirth. He's not only a coach, speaker, and co-author of a new book, The Positivity Tribe, he's also CEO of No Quit Living. And among his many insights he shares is about how lifting others up enables us to rise with them and fosters a positive mental advantage to navigate through hardship and still prosper. So be sure to catch what is somehow another not-to-be-missed guest episode. Speaking of which, is also last week's solo show that, I might add, segues seamlessly into today's topic. That's right, we dove fully into the depths of perception and how, among all the things we cannot control in life, this is not one of them. Let's put it this way. There's a reason why optimism and pessimism still apply to the very same set of circumstances. Somewhere in the middle of those extremes lies objectivity, which is to say true reality. And really, how often can we be absolutely certain that what we perceive at any given time is 100% accurate? At least I hope you realize that question was rhetorical. The point here is that when your inner monologue runs rampant, just cut yourself a break and be nothing less than kind. And unless you're 100% certain in how you perceive others, it would be likely a good thing to see if there's some benefit of the doubt to give them. In short, what I'm saying is that perception is the ultimate filter in how we interpret and experience our world within and around us. That also puts it at the heart of life enrichment, along with what we discussed is another major filter when it comes to earned confidence and how true joy happens in the present moment as opposed to getting hung up on the past or caught up in future uncertainties. This all brings us to the third, and for the most part, final major filter in our lives, that being about mood health. It does feel like we've gotten everything in reasonably solid context, which means it's time to start minding your mood health. Now, I'm not sure if you've been getting the feeling that there's some hesitation with this more than somewhat taboo topic, which may be less of a dose of positivity as it is one of reality. However, one promise you can rely on me to keep is to share practical insights and actionable guidance with a slant of hopefulness. As I've already disclosed, I am among those who've had to battle depression, which has had its way with me numerous times since my early teens. And it's something I've kept to myself my whole life. And it's remained very private until recently with the book coming out. For one, I felt it would have been hypocritical to discuss these topics without disclosing my own struggles. I'm also well aware that the vast majority of people have had to contend with similar challenges in the past and or in the here and now. So it's something I know is important to take head on rather than dance around. This also comes with a sense of responsibility to walk the talk, along with the opportunity to make a difference, knowing it could help others to hear me lean in. And so, since publishing Zeaisms, I've had the privilege to guest on in upwards of 100 podcast and radio shows. A number of those conversations being expansive, both in terms of the breadth of the topic, personal disclosures, and the increasing relevance to listeners going through greater challenges. Some of these shows focused on overcoming adversity, and along the way, I've definitely faced my share of unexpected questions, many of which have continued to expand my comfort zone, as well as my discomfort zone. It's been harder than expected to put myself out there, but I continue to push forward, and it's meant and means a lot to me to continue to do more of the same, especially here with you. And these being very heartfelt disclosures, I just want to say thank you again for allowing me to share my story with you. Through it all, I continue to learn a lot, both in general and to an even greater extent, more about myself. And this topic also hits more than close to home. I did not exactly inherit the best gene pool. My dad was bipolar, who was less than committed to manage his disorder properly, in part out of ego, and I think another due to stigma. And this led to his being imbalanced more often than I'd ever care to document, nor dishonor his memory. He passed in 2006, which was 10 years to the week after my mom, who unfortunately also suffered terribly from depression for most of her young life. She was also a suicide survivor, which happened just after my 12th birthday, and is also too much of a digression for here. Sadly, my brother David, who is closest to me in age, eventually succumbed to his battle in 2012, and more extenuating circumstances there too. So the stakes are much higher whenever suicide runs in your family. And as the years add up, I've also had to grieve through losing several other friends and loved ones, all gone too soon. And I think anyone who's had to confront suicide knows the pain and loss of an untimely death, what it leaves in its wake, and it's especially difficult to find full closure. And there's just this gaping hole with unanswered questions and deep sorrow among those left behind who remain kind of like a walking wounded. There was one particular interview where the host kept probing through all of this to the point where I really did need to take pause and compose myself. And at the same time, I found it striking how it all added up when hearing myself saying it all at once. But am I really all that different from most people? As much as it racks up to hear myself talk about it, I believe the truth about these experiences is that they're not all that different from those of most people in one way, shape, or form. Seriously, who among us are without a family member or a close friend who've faced a mental health event at some point. It runs in almost everyone's family, whether overtly or not. One fact is that at least 1 in 8 people rely on antidepressants for one reason or another. So the odds are you are among them or have loved ones who are. And then there's the question of how many more people could benefit by doing the same. And believe me, I'm not an advocate for over-medicating, but I definitely am for those in need. There are a lot of people suffering in silence, and even more now with the impact of COVID. Even still, the reality is that there remain numerous barriers to treatment, not the least of which being the societal stigmas that persist and I think are important to confront. And so that leads us to the indignities of our society, how these stigmas persist and how that creates any number of barriers, including for people who resist the help they need. There's no shame in taking the best care of yourself. Even in what's supposed to be a modern era of scientific advancement, I'm not sure why society still separates mood and mental health from physical wellness. I think it's accurate to say the brain is a vital body part. I do think some strides have been made and the stigmas have dissipated to a degree, but we're still nowhere close to moving beyond those barriers about mental health affliction, which means we're that much more on our own. Now let's talk about maintenance medications for a minute. Like off the top of my head are statins to keep high cholesterol in check, or some take blood thinners, or others to regulate their thyroid, or even take sleeping pills. Those are for the brain. So are treatments for diseases like multiple sclerosis, but is distinguished because that affects the body. Even daily vitamins are a fair example. These are socially acceptable. Even still, whatever medications taken are still done in privacy. So why would anyone still have a hang-up about taking the best care of themselves? Because society says so? Looking at this another way, my son Jake blew out his ACL playing soccer. He's actually had a pretty rough go with multiple surgeries and many months of rehab. Now, what if there was a stigma about ACL surgery? People say, oh, elective surgery is a waste of money and a selfish burden on the healthcare system, right? I mean, people can live without an ACL, so what if you can't play competitive sports? That's life. Instead, you know, people tell you, you know, go learn piano or photography or, you know, underwater basket weaving for that matter. Would you still listen to society and not get that surgery and never play the sport you love again? Well, I hope the answer is no. That's what you love. Hopefully we've reached the point beyond obvious. However temporary or persistent a mood or mental health impairment, we can classify this as being sick in much the same way as one might catch a cold in mild cases or have the flu or pneumonia in moderate or more severe cases, respectively. All right, I think that covers that, except for the stigma with professional counseling. And if you happen to catch my bringing this up before regarding my mom, it was about when in my early 20s, our parents brought us together with a family therapist to disclose her terminal illness and how we all work through that and support her. That was a good decision. What about marriage counseling? Do you think society should have a problem with trying to save a committed relationship? And yet, so many people resist and judge others about having a personal therapist. What strikes me even more about this is the growing industry with having a life coach. Like, we admire those who invest in themselves to be a better leader or achieve their full potential, but somehow it's less acceptable for those coping with whatever life challenges or needing to address greater instability or seeking to make more sense of their past. There's still this prevailing restraint about personal therapy. Like, No way am I calling up some witch doctor to lie on some proverbial couch. This is especially true for guys. And I admit, it's something I had to get out of my own way about, which was also about 30 years ago. You know, being this tough guy, jock, hockey player, I get it. But there's also something to be said for being strong enough on the inside to know something's wrong and when you need help. And it doesn't have to be a forever thing. Like, it's been 7 years since I felt it was necessary for me. But if and when that need arises, I'm well past having any hang-ups about it. Here's where, if there's any one silver lining with COVID, it's that it's made telehealth entirely accessible. So many people continue to suffer in silence, and now they can just reach out online and get near immediate support from a professional, go through an intake, see where they're at, and discuss options. So if you're still not sure, then 800-950-6264 is the NAMI helpline. That number again is 800-950-6264. For those with whom this resonates, there's everything right about getting professional support and, again, taking the best care of yourself. That said, let's also put the rest of this conversation into context by distinguishing between our addressing mood health versus the broader and more commonly used term mental health. For one, knowing that I can only speak from experience and to some degree observation in talking about mood health, this topic only applies to the ranges of depression, bipolar, also called manic depressive disorder, and to a limited degree, anxiety. We're not getting into specialty areas like ADHD or PTSD, Asperger's syndrome, and surely not the likes of schizophrenia. So I hope that clears that up. And while at it, let's be sure we've got something else straight. I am not a doctor, and hereby declare that there is nothing you are hearing today that is meant to be misconstrued as medical advice. In fact, come to think of it, I made an official disclaimer at the end of the introductory episode zero, so it's due to make an encore appearance if you'd care to stick around. Having said that, while no, I am still not a doctor, there is something to be said for there being no substitute for experience. It's one thing to study a topic to earn an academic degree and be in practice treating others, but that's where that expertise stops. A clinician cannot fully know what it's like to be in someone's head or how it feels to be on the receiving end of treatment. It's just a disconnect. And the same is true of the more fortunate majority of the population who, they themselves, have not experienced a clinical imbalance. And so there's something to be said for being someone who's been through it, which is why I believe I'm in a credible position to add value. And that brings us to an illustration in Z-isms of what's called a mood scale. And as with the perception snapshot grid, you also don't have to see this mood scale to visualize that as being a lot like a thermometer. In the very center is a line to represent perfect mood balance, which of course isn't possible for anyone to sustain. Most people function in a normal range of happy and sad, and it matters less about how one defines normal as much as that everyone identifies with having a certain range of happiness and sadness based on their individual experience. Then there are those who must contend with increased instability in either direction, the more typical one being downward. So the mood scale descends through mild, moderate, and severe depression to the very depths of despair. It also elevates above the stable happy range into hypomania, mania, up to psychosis, and beyond the edge of madness. Again, this illustration is not a static drawing. Everyone is different. It's also natural for people to dip or rise beyond the normal range, especially with many challenging life events everyone inevitably encounters. So with that in mind, it's a reasonable assumption that a lot of people know what it's like to experience at least a low level of clinical depression. Also, in much the same way, if you think of the times in your life that brought you somewhere in the vicinity of cloud nine, that will give you a sense of the minor elevation into hypomania. For our purposes, we'll focus on what's above or below the normal range on the mood scale, where the experience persists for a sustained period and legitimately may be defined as experiencing mental imbalance. This is also where we are no longer in the category of excessive happiness or sadness, in which normal, healthy individuals possess the elasticity to bounce back. This is more in the realm of physical brain chemistry. People elevating into a hypomanic state present a greater danger to themselves or others and exhibit increasingly erratic behavior, among other symptoms. I believe the physical affliction at the root of abnormal mood health relates to the speed of how slowly or rapidly one's synapses fire when sending messages from one nerve cell to another. In an elevated range, these neurotransmitters overwhelm and wear down brain function. Like with my dad, for example, I have enough experience with this to know it can be tempting to hold on to euphoric feelings, but they become increasingly unstable and unsustainable. In contrast, depression poses a much greater threat when it reaches a moderate level, with the sufferer no longer able to pull out of it. The true insidiousness of this affliction, especially at the lower level, is that depression is almost indiscernible to the sufferer, let alone observers. It can be as subtle as a persistent lack of motivation to do basic tasks. It may be that you are falling behind on things and are unsure why. The person may find that keeping up with life's demands feels more like wading through quicksand. The deeper the depression, the further they sink, and the harder it becomes to escape. Depression creeps up on you. It physically sabotages your brain and impedes you from living life to the fullest. It's often not until you lift out of that funk that you realize you have been out of touch with feeling like yourself and that you have been depressed all along. This is likely after extended periods of time. We also need to take a closer look at symptoms of mood elevation, those being manic impulses, behaviors, and increasingly something more overt. In contrast to how depression creeps up on you and stays under the surface for prolonged periods, manic behavior is exponentially obvious and often worsens rapidly. Left unchecked, it becomes more destructive as one approaches the edge of madness. As with mild depression, hypomania can dramatically skew one's perception, the main difference being that elevation is a lot less obvious to the person experiencing it, while depression is more obvious to those who know they battle it. Now, for those who've fallen into the mild range for whatever reasons and for however long, keep in mind that, as bad as that feels, it's still nowhere near what it's like to be in the depths of moderate and severe depression, where everything is much more distorted. And like we talked about with perception, you're now only able to see the world with the opposite of rose-colored lenses. Everything is just gray and bleak, spiraling with hopelessness. Here's the thing. As much as circumstances are what they are in terms of severity and feel magnified, there's still some degree of misperception. What's important to keep in mind about the mood scale overall is how it corresponds with feelings and actions you and others experience progressively. If others close to you observe a change in behavior, be it a downward spiral or increasing hyperactivity, then you or that person need a confidant. Speaking with someone you trust or being there for someone else gives you or that person a safety net. The challenge for those who play that support role is that those suffering often close themselves off. And this was the case with my brother. We lived close together, and his struggles persisted to varying degrees over a period of years. And he's still in that certain bubble with his immediate family, so it was hard to know what kind of trouble he was in at any given time. There's also a tendency among sufferers to push others away, especially your loved ones. The fact of the matter is that there's no easy answer here, and that every person and circumstance are different. But what I will say, if you really think someone is on the cusp or beyond the point of being able to keep themselves safe, trust your gut. Make the harder choice of the two. Instead of staying away, you may need to intervene, especially when uninvited. So as we continue to visualize the mood scale described, is there anything that resonates for you about anyone in particular in your life? Does anyone need to hear from you? Where on the scale do you see yourself? Is that in the normal range and still having the ability to bounce back when life leads you into those danger zones? Again, who gets to define normalcy and the happy-sad range as being clinically healthy versus there being a physical-chemical imbalance that potentially requires greater intervention? That is one role of mental health professionals, but you must still trust yourself. Now, given that we are, in fact, addressing specific medical afflictions, too important to gloss over, and I am, in fact, still not a doctor, this is where an assist from the experts makes sense. In this case, let's rely on a quick consult from our friends at the Mayo Clinic, which specifies the clinical description of depression as follows. A major depressive episode includes symptoms that are severe enough to cause noticeable difficulty in day-to-day activities, such as work, school, social activities, or relationships. An episode includes five or more of the following symptoms: depressed mood, such as feeling sad, empty, hopeless, or tearful. In children and teens, depressed mood can appear as irritability. Marked loss of interest or feeling, no pleasure in all or almost all activities. Significant weight loss when not dieting, weight gain, or decrease or increase in appetite. In children, failure to gain weight as expected can be a sign of depression. Insomnia or sleeping too much. Restlessness or slowed behavior. Fatigue or loss of energy. Feelings of worthlessness and excessive or inappropriate guilt. Decreased ability to think or concentrate. Indecisiveness. Thinking about, planning, or attempting suicide. Continuing on here, the Mayo Clinic also defines unstable elevation as follows. Mania and hypomania are two distinct types of episodes, but they have the same symptoms. Mania is more severe than hypomania and causes more noticeable problems at work, school, and social activities, as well as relationship difficulties. Mania may also trigger a break from reality, that being psychosis, and require hospitalization. Both a manic and a hypomanic episode include three or more of the following symptoms: abnormally upbeat, jumpy, or wired, increased activity, energy, or agitation, exaggerated sense of well-being and self-confidence, euphoria, decreased need for sleep, unusual talkativeness, racing thoughts, distractibility, poor decision-making, for example, going on buying sprees, taking sexual risks, or making foolish investments. From my vantage point, as thorough and valuable these clinical textbook definitions are, they still somehow fall short in terms of what it's like. If you've never had the misfortune of truly being in the grips of severe depression and the depths of despair, consider yourself lucky. Looking back, I now know it started in my early teens, but I really didn't fully realize it until my early to mid-20s. Part of that is that there was this sluggishness, but then I'd do things that would give me a lift, especially playing ice hockey. And I didn't get fully proactive until my mom's diagnosis, knowing that I'd need more support to get through that and in being a caregiver. So there's some hard living involved here, but I made it through. And fortunately, it's been a number of years since I've had a major bout. I believe a lot of people suffer from seasonal affective disorder, to a certain degree, and I am more susceptible in those winter months, so I have to compensate for that by taking better care of myself. So how do you recognize it? For me, it's that feeling of sinking in quicksand. You may find that you are increasingly verbally abusive to yourself, and begin to accept those criticisms and feelings as absolutes. You're basically hating on yourself, for real. That voice in your head is literally telling you what an idiot you are, or how fat or ugly, or whatever. This brings us back to the implied fact that each of us are the only ones who truly know what we are experiencing. This is also coupled with a sense of hopelessness, which might sound something like, I will never be happy again. There's that sluggishness as well as desire for distraction, especially with watching TV and playing video games. And nothing against binge-watching your favorite shows, but one binge-watch after another can turn a few days into weeks and even months. It's too easy to lose time. And I have. If you've dipped beyond mild into moderate depression, you definitely know you're depressed. That brings us to the ultimate question to answer, what to do about it. Personally, my first line of defense is what I call the 3-day rule. I'm realistic about my fair share of down days. Sometimes it can be weather-related, others have to do with work experiences, which often involve being punched or kicked in one place or another. I think most entrepreneurs can attest that it comes with the territory. But if I get to that third day, I know to make myself the priority by getting into action. Those who know me would agree that I gravitate toward positivity and optimism, so I'll do a self-check-in about whether that's beginning to fade. Whatever else is going on, it's secondary. It's an attitude about putting yourself first and knowing that it doesn't make you selfish. The thing with the 3-day rule is that, at least in my experience, is that for every additional day someone sinks deeper into depression or elevates, it may take 2 more days to rebound. Of course, that's not a hard and fast rule. And personally, I'm a slow mover on the mood scale, but there's still a distinct progression. And here's where we're in the zone of knowing it's essential to take a dose of prevention, or at the very least, avert things from worsening. If unchecked, it could lead to a clinically legitimate health event. So that's a strong motivation by itself to get into action. This naturally means different things to different people, but what we're talking about here are coping skills. It starts by taking the best care of yourself. First and foremost is to get to the gym. Physical exercise is by far the single most beneficial action anyone can take to get their head straight. So, dust off the stationary bike or whatever to do some cardio to get your endorphins up. Obviously, if you don't go or can't get to the gym, then do a home workout. If there was ever a case of something being easier said than done, this is that challenge. Here's where you literally have to parent yourself. Like, what do you know you need to do and not give yourself the option not to do? Start there. Now, beyond exercise and staying in motion, it's essential to get enough sleep, eat well, and insulate yourself from stress. Another key is to have structure and then force yourself to stick to that plan. Again, knowing you probably won't feel like it. One helpful option is to make your phone a taskmaster by setting alerts. If helpful, then confide in a trusted friend to be your accountability partner. Get into some sort of daily physical routine, be it to take a walk or some other activities that get you or your loved ones out of the house. Interpersonal energy is another factor. Be proactive to insulate yourself from those who bring you down. But rather than isolate, seek those who lift you up. And what else lifts you up? Listening to your favorite music, watching comedies, or even listening to helpful podcasts, which I just happen to highly recommend. We all have our down days. The 3-day rule is a good practice for anyone, including if you consider your mood range to be normal. Now, what if the 3-day rule has come and gone, and you're sinking deeper and deeper into depression? Things along the lines of what I described earlier. For one, recognize that you do not have to suffer in silence. It's very difficult to see how darkly your depressed perceptions color your world. It was nearly 20 years ago when someone I trust and who knows me well said something that helped me get through the despair of a deeper depression. And they pointed out that no matter how bad you feel or how things may seem, you will feel better at some point. Things won't always be this way. And it's a real life preserver to remind yourself or someone close enough who you know to be clinically depressed or hypomanic. And I saw something along these lines that was similar, that if you rearrange the letters in the word depression, you'll get I pressed on. Your current situation is not your destination. Whoever is suffering may only be able to connect with this conceptually. They might not know what it's going to take and may not have the answer. They certainly don't feel it, but there is a part of them that really does know things won't always feel this bad, and they'll find their way out of it somehow, some way. This also connects with the aspect around earned confidence to be nothing less than kind to yourself. As hard as it is, tell that voice to piss off. Just draw that line in the sand and rely on that as your barometer. That is the tangible building block for self-esteem, self-love, and self-respect. You're either being kind or you're not. Instead, try to reconnect with the joy in life. Stay grounded in the present and practice gratitude. And here's where you may find the perception snapshot to be helpful too. Having said that, it's reasonable to consider that summoning one's earned confidence can only get them so far when they are fully in the thick of things emotionally. If you ever find yourself unable to rebound, or you feel like you're in a free fall and sinking lower, then I implore and encourage you to seek help. This also certainly applies to helping someone else in need. If you or someone close to you is in trouble or headed for it, please take charge and seek help for everyone's benefit. Therapy is a sensible choice. And again, telehealth is much more accessible to get an immediate intake with a professional in private. There are other lifelines out there to just talk with someone. These may be volunteers who are trained to just be a good listener and be the first step to see if they recommend an evaluation. Beyond therapy is when there's an actual chemical imbalance. Medication may be the only intervention and course to restore well-being, especially with manic elevation. Personally, in such cases, I believe that medication is at least 80% of the solution, which is to say that no amount of talk therapy will restore well-being. It may be a matter of medication still being a partial solution, but do not wait and prolong unnecessary suffering. And a critical note here is that often it is very difficult to schedule psychiatric appointments quickly or frequently enough. Again, telehealth intervention is a viable option, but otherwise, if warranted, put any hangups aside and check yourself into a reputable private inpatient facility or some other high level of care where medical professionals are readily available to closely monitor medications and mood stability. This may be the best course of action to rebalance brain chemistry and restore physical health in the shortest amount of time to help the sufferer return to their true self. Remember that some people aren't as fortunate to find the right medication the first time. No one said the remedy for mood balance was a walk in the park. And it's no picnic with the side effects people may have to endure. It takes time to find the right medication to balance mood impairment, let alone at the right dose to be administered the right way. You do whatever it takes. If you find that is the case personally, then patience, persistence, and self-compassion are vital to your core health. It doesn't get much more oversimplified than that. There is just no other way but through. If I may be direct for a moment, this is your life, and it's not just about you. People are counting on you to take care of yourself and to stick around. With everything so magnified and not entirely reality-based, you may start to think that the world would be better off without me. And thinking back to one of my media interviews, the host asked a very pointed question, which was whether I ever felt like giving up. Of course, I knew the answer right away, but decided to take a long pause to gather my thoughts, knowing the importance of what I was about to say. And I was honest, as well as underscored how I've always promised myself that checking out is never an option, in part because of my experience with my mom's attempt, and especially as a dad myself. You just don't go there. Having the reminder that things will get better at some point and how there's no other way but through leads to knowing that there are only two courses of action to either continue to suffer for however long or to get help. At that point, it's also important to admit that you can't do it alone, and you shouldn't have to, for that matter, to get on the road to recovery. I mentioned one number earlier, and here's another to the Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is also in the book. That's 800-273-TALK, which is 8255. That's 800-273-8255. As we wind down here, I do want to acknowledge that there's a certain percentage of the population that, for one reason or another, refuses to take medication. I personally have limited knowledge of natural remedies to balance brain chemistry. However, I recently saw an interesting chart, appropriately called Happiness Chemicals and How to Hack Them. So here's a quick rundown. First is dopamine, referred to as the reward chemical and activated by completing a task, doing self-care activities, eating food, celebrating little wins. Next is serotonin, the mood stabilizer, activated by meditating, running, sun exposure, walking in nature, swimming, cycling. Third is endorphins, the painkiller, a laughter exercise, essential oils, watch a comedy, dark chocolate, exercising. Last is oxytocin, activated by playing with a dog or a baby, give a compliment, holding hands, hugging your family. In wanting to be thorough here, I noticed what is not mentioned in the chart, which is what I know to be another relevant brain chemical, is norepinephrine, abbreviated as NE, which is also called noradrenaline. I did a little research on this, indicating that this chemical acts primarily as a neurotransmitter in your nervous system, but can also act as a hormone in the body, and it plays a key role in many important functions. NE is classified as an excitatory neurotransmitter, which means it stimulates activity in the brain, boosting the function of different cells to keep your brain and body running efficiently. A somewhat high NE activity level makes you happy, and a really high level makes you euphoric. Many recreational drugs get people high by increasing levels of norepinephrine and the related neurotransmitter dopamine. Of course, I am not advocating drug use here. The main reference found were about foods that can specifically increase it, including bananas, chicken, chocolate, eggs, fish, and seafood, meat, oatmeal. Foods that contain the amino acid tyrosine are particularly recommended, which include cheese and other dairy products, soybeans, nuts, and whole grains, as well as beans and legumes. I realize we may be going a bit deeper than typical, but there are no shortcuts here. My sense about these natural remedies and activities are that they can help ward off depression as well as to bounce back from low-level depression. A lot of them are coping skills. They may be also particularly beneficial for depression related to environmental and circumstantial events rather than an imbalance warranting medication to correct brain chemistry. This segues into our final topic, which is specific to COVID and how a lot more people are much more susceptible with everything going on. So many of us are out of our daily routines and the structure, especially with working virtually. Whether that's not dressing up and experiencing the feelings of having purpose or interacting with colleagues, this is all part of our self-identity, which then takes its toll on our confidence and overall self-esteem. This takes on greater significance knowing that more and more people are faced with hardship, especially job loss. There's even the whole aspect of no longer having the freedom, like recreational outlets and restrictions from other things we love to do and had taken for granted. Even this is not something to gloss over or ignore, but rather confront these losses and go through whatever process of grieving. And then there's the ultimate grief with the loss of life, presently approaching 200,000 people in the U.S. alone. Think about that. There are a lot of people hurting right now. I actually heard from a police officer friend of mine who said that in the initial weeks after COVID, that the suicide rate increased dramatically and that the increase has held steady. So the long-term repercussions of our collective and individual mental well-being from COVID is far from known. I'm actually considering doing a guest episode with an expert who can speak more authoritatively on these critical issues. But for now, at the very least, just making time and space to feel true sadness about all of this is essential. That said, I hope you found that everything we've talked about here is of some comfort and benefit. It's been far from the most uplifting episode, but definitely ranks high in terms of importance. With that, I would like to offer a counterbalance of high energy along with a healthy infusion of positivity by having you join me and next week's guest, Anthony Trucks, former NFL player, American Ninja Warrior, and now CEO of Identity Shift, also the title of his forthcoming book. Anthony delivers the insights to make a life upgrade and a path to become the best version of yourself. So I'm not really sure how that can be anything less than a can't-be-missed conversation with a highly inspirational, motivational, and I'm just going to say, kind of a borderline superhero. And one final footnote is that among all of my shows until now, as with mentioning the podcast and introducing others to it, is to make the ask to have you simply go and check out my book. Zeism's Insights to Live By is meant to be read, and I think you'll find worth the read. It's also free to read the first part on my site or on Amazon, which is enough to know whether anyone wants to read on by buying a copy for themselves and or It makes a terrific gift, which I do say so myself. All right, that's it for me. I most sincerely appreciate your listening in and listening on. Hope you enjoyed this episode of Insights to Live By. Be sure to connect with me on Instagram and Twitter at Matthew Zinman and join our community at insightstoliveby.com. Wishing you and yours an enriching day, and we'll see you next time. Although the host and our producers have made every effort and will continue to make every effort to ensure that the information in Insights to Live By, the podcast, continues to be correct, we cannot assume and hereby disclaim any liability to any party for loss, damage, or disruption caused by errors or omissions, whether such errors or omissions result from negligence, accident, or other cause. The host and producers of this show, Insights to Live By, the podcast, do not dispense medical advice or prescribe the use of any technique, either directly or indirectly, as a form of treatment for physical, emotional, or medical problems without the advice of a physician. The host and producers' intent is only to offer information of a general nature to help you in your quest for emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being. In the event you use any of the information from Insights to Live By, the podcast, the host and the producers assume and cannot assume any responsibility for your actions.